This is Inputs, the podcast by Top Crop Manager, Canada's national source for the latest agronomic research, crop production, and technology trends. You've tuned in to hear conversations about relevant research, best production practices, and everything in between.
If I asked you, what's the most important tool on your farm? You'd probably think of tractors, trucks, and implements first. But it's actually something much bigger than that. Your soil is the most important equipment you own. The real question is, are you doing enough to keep it running at peak performance? Nutrient Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST is engineered with patented micronized sulfur technology to refuel your soil for maximum yields. Learn how to tune up your soil at smartnutritionmst.com.
Hi, welcome to another episode of Inputs, the podcast by Top Crop Manager. I'm Stephanie Crowley, your host for this episode. And today joining me from Saskatoon is Dr. Tyler Wyss from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. He's a field crop entomologist in Saskatoon. So Tyler, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Stephanie. Appreciate it.
I hope I still got your title right there.
I was very impressed. Well done.
Okay. Good stuff. So I've introduced you, but I would love for you to introduce yourself and share a little bit about yourself with our listeners, your background and experience in the industry and what you're currently focusing on.
Okay. Well, my name is Tyler Wyss. I'm a research scientist at Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada based in Saskatoon. So my main topic is field crop entomology. So that can be pretty broad. But I'll say that wheat's my main line. Wheat midge is one of the big pests that I work on there. But of course, flea beetles are a big problem in canola. So you don't see them every year, but pea aphids are a big problem in a lot of our pulse crops as well. So I've been working on those too. So my background is I've been here in Saskatoon for a few years now. Before that, I did a PhD at the University of Alberta, working on little wasp that was attacking a caterpillar. So got into the field here. And then before that, working in a very specialty field crop area, I was looking at pollination in echinacea crops. And so that was really interesting.
Cool. But
what I found in that echinacea crop was a real tie-in to a big pest that we had at the time were grasshoppers. And we had a couple of field heroes, a couple of beneficial insects that were visiting the echinacea as pollinators, and then their offspring were eating grasshopper eggs. So probably pick that up later on because we had a lot of trouble with grasshoppers this year.
No kidding. I was in the Langham area in July and in Saskatchewan, and oh my gosh, the grasshoppers in the field that I was in were very prominent, and that was obviously a very small section and very small comparison to what I'm sure a lot of producers saw.
Yeah, last year we had those really hot, dry conditions in 2021 and a really long fall period. And so that just gives those grasshoppers the opportunity to lazily lay around in the sun, lay a lot of eggs, and not get killed by the fungus that often keeps their populations down, because the fungus does well under wet conditions and then the grasshoppers do well under those hot, dry conditions. So yeah, we had at least three pest species. You could find them in a lot of fields. So you walk in and they just be hopping everywhere, mostly two-striped. They were the dominant, but we also had some clear wing and some lesser migratory as well.
Okay, very good. So that was in 2021 or was that in 2022 that you were finding those a little bit more?
So grasshoppers build up population-wise in 1 year, so 2021. Mm-hmm. Lots of them were laying eggs, and then those eggs, they overwinter, and then we see them again in 2022. Right. So those are populations that you can watch from an entomology point of view build up over time.
I see. Okay. Let's chat a little bit about what else you saw in 2022. There's some, you know, a few insects that were pretty prominent, I think, in the prairies. Anything in particular that you came across that really piqued your interest that you wanted to share today?
Yeah. So off of that grasshopper bit, we've got something that I'm always saying, hey, that's a beneficial insect. That's a field hero. And those are crickets that I'm referring to, because crickets like to eat grasshopper eggs. So a lot of grasshopper eggs last year. We had a lot of crickets this year. And then we start getting images coming in of crickets eating canola and crickets eating other crops. And I just have to, go, here I am saying they're beneficial. And then here they are eating people's crops. There's no economic thresholds for crickets, but I mean, they probably do very similar damage to a grasshopper would do. And why are they eating crops and not grasshopper eggs? Well, these things are omnivores. So, they'll eat whatever's out there. One of the agronomists who I was working with on the Wheat Midge hashtag Midge Busters project, she was sending me pictures of a dead mouse and dead birds eaten, like from the feather stage all the way down to the bone stage by crickets. And so, if it's out there, crickets will eat it. So my apologies to everyone who I said, crickets are nice. And then they turn around and start eating crops.
No kidding. I had seen on Twitter kind of towards the end of August that you were asking about crickets and where they've been found. And so it's interesting to hear that, they were kind of a widespread issue and a lot more omnivorous than we think.
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't have expected them to eat a dead mouse, but there they went.
No kidding.
Yeah. So with the cricket population boom and the grasshopper boom, there are two other field heroes, and these guys are not omnivores when they're adults like the crickets are. And those are bee flies and blister beetles. So bee flies, they're just like they sound. They're a fly, but they try to make you think that they're a bee. They have the mimetic coloration patterns of a bee, so that you're like, ooh, I'm not going to touch you because you might be kind of stingy. But they've got, instead of a modified ovipositor for stinging on their back end, they've got a long proboscis, so a really long nose on their front end, and they use that for drinking nectar. So, and then they've got really big fuzzy bodies. They're very good pollinators. So, and we've seen them boom way back in 2002 when I was working on my master's in echinacea. They boomed then because of the grasshopper population, and they're booming now because of the grasshopper population. And so those blister beetles, the ones in the genus Meloidiae, so they would be like the ash gray blister beetle and the black blister beetle. Yes, very, very awesome common names, hey? Very descriptive.
Yeah, exactly.
But also the golden blister beetle, and guess what color it is? It's golden. And those three populations were booming as well. Now, they're a little more dicey when they're adults. So I determined that they're actually pretty good pollinators of echinacea, but the ash gray and the black will get into pulse crops and alfalfa, and they'll chew on leaves and things, so. Gotcha. They can be minor problems as well.
The way that you're describing some of these, they sound like they should be like, the pests in a video game, like the long nose and the fuzzy bodies, and they sound almost cartoon-like. I'm picturing in my head. So
that's a great idea. the bee fly. Yeah, if you get up close and personal with a bee fly, you could look at it and go, "You are kind of comical." I could see them in a cartoon. So. When I worked for pest management, we were doing mosquito control, and we'd have the vests with the big yellow X's on them.
Yeah.
And the bee flies would come, and they would land on the yellow X, and they would try to drink nectar from it. So that was pretty comical.
That's funny.
Very confused those things can get.
No kidding. Well, it sounds like there have been some really interesting things that you've come across in the last several years, of course, when you're talking about doing your master's and such, but even recently. So
just saying those dates out loud feels like I'm getting old here.
No, but there's lots to learn, right? Lots of things to
Still plenty of things to learn. That's right.
Yeah, and lots of trends, I would imagine, right? As you're saying, like those kinds of things were happening so many years ago and now are coming back. We follow those patterns.
Yeah. So the last grasshopper outbreak around here, like the big grasshopper outbreak, would have been 20 years ago, which, you just forget all about the grasshoppers and then here they come roaring back. So
yep, there you go.
Hopefully this year, the rainy times got that fungus going, and maybe the predators will knock back the eggs enough that we don't have a big issue again in 2023.
Okay. Here's hoping.
Yeah. Here's hoping.
Yeah. That's all we can do, I guess. Right. So any other insights or anything from growers that you came across of insect problems or any other new things that have cropped up that you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah. So the hot, dry conditions of 2021 not only drove grasshopper populations, we had, I was doing a project on pea aphids, and it sure didn't drive the pea aphid populations. Mm. Pea aphids are more of a temperate insect. They like it around 20 degrees Celsius. So I planted some big plots and we were doing spray timing, and the pea aphid population basically burned. It was just too hot for them. It was above their thermal threshold, I think.
Yeah.
And so a lot of sad fields that didn't have any aphids in them. Well, okay, the fields were happy, but the researcher in them was sad.
Right.
So that wasn't the case this year. We had a much more temperate climate and the pea aphids. I turned my back on my fava bean fields this year and basically lost both of them to pea aphids.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Whereas the peas and the lentils, I had those in the large plots again, and we were keeping very close track, very close eye on those aphid populations. And we laid down the spray treatments when we needed to, and we're just combining those right now to get the yield results from it, to see what see what shook out of those spray trials. Mm-hmm. But Liguus bugs last year started coming on, and Hector Carcamo and I have a theory about that. Well, a lot of entomologists are getting theories about that. So Hector got money just over 5 years ago to look at Liguus bugs in canola and looking at the threshold again. And he said, "Hey, Tyler, do you know of any sites where we've got Liguus bugs?" And I'm finding Liguus bugs everywhere here in 2015. So okay. Yeah, I think we can definitely do this project. 2016 rolled around, came in, and all the Liguus bugs disappeared. So Hector uses a picture of me with my arms up in the air like this, because every time he asked me for data, I said, I haven't seen a Liguus bug this whole year, Hector.
Oh, no.
So I've been planting these canola crops at our research farm just in anticipation of these Liguus bugs. And then last year, we started getting Liguus bugs in the field. I said, oh, awesome. So I laid down the spray treatment that we had planned like 5 years before. And then I realized, oh, this project's over. We actually ran out of money the year before on this project. And then what happened? Well, the Liguus figured it out and they just came roaring back now that we weren't studying them.
Of course.
Yeah, but I did it anyway. So I gave Hector some data finally in year six of a 5-year project.
Enhanced control of early season flea beetles and cutworms. Leading protection from seedling disease complex and blackleg. Win the start with Corteva canola seed treatments. Ask your local seed supplier.
And then this year, because the population started to build last year when it was hot and dry, my canola field. So last year I had maybe 3 to 5 Liguus per sweep, which is right around our kind of economic threshold that we've been working with. And this year it was more like 23 to 25 per sweep.
Wow.
So a really big increase, in the canola. And then I had planted the fava bean fields for a Liguus experiment as well. But, you know, like I said, turned my back on them, pea aphids.
No kidding.
But last year when I was laying down the spray treatments in the fava bean for the pea aphids, and the pea aphids didn't touch the crop because they burned off and we didn't get any pea aphid pressure. We had just fantastic Liguus pressure in the fava beans. And so if you've ever seen a fava bean that's been fed upon by Liguus, it turns that bean ugly. So, you get this kind of big black crater on it, and you get enough of those in a sample, and no human wants to eat that.
No kidding.
Want, you know, perfect and pristine. So you go over, say, 1 or 2%, and your whole fava bean crop goes to cattle feed because they don't care about black craters. They'll eat it.
Yeah.
But then you get a whole downgrade in the price that you're getting for your crop. And so I had my students in there, and they were counting the number of craters on these fava bean seeds, looking at, you know, like 100 seeds per plot, and trying to figure out the percentages of fava beans that were damaged. And so the Lygus did a like a big cosmetic damage to my fava beans last year.
Oh, wow.
So I was hoping for that again this year. And then no fava beans this year. Bee aphids killed them, but they were in the canola. So I devised a spray treatment plan for them and laid it down. When we hit those, well, not when we hit the thresholds, it was way beyond threshold. So I should have been paying closer attention perhaps to that. But they were at a stage, the seeds were at a stage when they still should have been able to be damaged by Lygus bugs. But looking at the field, I actually had three problems in that field. So had a lot of Lygus bugs. And we had diamondback moth that blew in as well. So the provinces, they monitor for diamondback moth using pheromone traps. And usually the pheromone trap monitoring ends after about 6 weeks, because the common understanding is that those diamondback moth have to come early enough to get lots of populations in to have a big buildup of populations. But in my fields, like, I had a lot of diamondback moths that showed up after the typical pheromone monitoring period ended. So I was like, well, how do I separate the Lygus bug feeding from the diamondback moth feeding? And so I was using two different insecticides, one that's more specific to Lygus bugs, and then one that should be specific just to diamondback moth, to see if I can pull apart those differences in my plots. But then I also had just a ton of crucifer flea beetles in the canola as well. So now I've got three insect problems ravaging the crop. And usually the second generation flea beetles are, you don't look at those and say, ah, those are not going to do a whole lot of damage. But I have heard of like potted canola being wiped out by big flea beetle populations. And so the flea beetle generation goes something like this. They overwinter as adults, then they move into the canola field when it's really young. And that's when the big problem happens, because they can wipe out small plants. So I had a project this year where we were trying to quantify flea beetle damage using artificial intelligence. So we're taking a lot of pictures of damaged plants. So I planted untreated canola because we wanted to get flea beetle damage. And then the large number of flea beetles that were in my field, plus the hot, dry conditions, wound up like, so the flea beetles will take little bites off of the plant, and then the plants just dried up and basically blew away. So I lost three full fields of canola to flea beetle damage. And I reseeded, and but then that all worked out, because then I got the Lygus bugs and the diamondback moth and the second generation flea beetles, and had a great time spraying each of them with different insecticides. So but that second generation of flea beetles, it goes ahead and it overwinters. But first off, at least the crucifer flea beetles, they just hang out in the canola field and they keep eating whatever's green there. So even 2 days ago, there were still a few green plants and they were covered in crucifer flea beetles. Yeah. So striped and crucifer are our two biggest problems. But I think the hot, dry conditions of 2021 really decreased the striped flea beetle population, at least in my fields, because they used to be dominant and now we can hardly find them for our experiments. So,
Well, yeah, good news and bad news. Good news for producers.
Yeah, that's right. But the crucifer flea beetle really stepped in to do the damage on
fill the gap.
That gap. And so what are they doing in the meantime between that first generation and that second generation? They're actually down on the roots of canola as larvae. And so that's never been shown to do any kind of economic damage, but it does mean that they come up out of the ground in mid-August or so, and they're right there in the fields. So I was trying to compensate for the flea beetles as well, trying to spray for them too. So that's what I've been up to.
Not much at all. No,
nah,
hardly anything. Yeah, no, it sounds like, as I said before, you know, when you say something comes in and wipes out a whole field, again, it's bad news for a grower, but not so much when you're looking to really attract those bugs and study them. And so really good news for you again. But sounds like you've had some interesting challenges and discoveries in the last couple of years. And funny that those hot, dry conditions from 2021, we knew we were going to see the ramifications of that for quite some time into 2022. And then, and, you know, we thought about that from like a herbicide carryover perspective, for example, right? But now, as you're saying, you know, with different insects overwintering in different phases and having different life cycles, you know, that can all impact what we're seeing in terms of insect pests, even after a year later, after a drought. So
yes, insect carryovers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the hot and dry didn't do any good things to the wheat midge population. So we were looking at wheat midge and trying to challenge our plants with wheat midge out in the field, and started out well. The wheat midge emerged in 2021, but then it just got so hot and dry. I think they kind of failed to thrive in the head. So good for farmers, not good for this guy as a researcher. And then the wheat midge forecast that Alberta and Saskatchewan ministries of ag put out, we're just like green for wheat midge. So that was good for from a producer point of view, definitely. But we ran year two of hashtag midge busters with CCAN, and we gave out wheat midge pheromone traps, and we said, well, you know what, let's just see if there is actually some wheat midge emergence. And even though we had like no forecasted wheat midge problems, there was a lot of wheat midge males at least being caught on traps in some places, and where some of the growers were able to go out and scout for females. Like, for example, up in the Peace River region, we had like 3 wheat midge per head, which is way, way, way over threshold. So not amazing. So if they didn't have a midge tolerant crop in there, that could be a real big problem. So it's made me realize that you don't turn your back on a wheat midge, even if you think that there's not going to be much of a problem. Like the right conditions, the right environment, and they just come roaring back.
No kidding. Never turn your back on a wheat midge. I like that.
There's
a,
yeah.
Yeah. Don't get too comfortable, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's say never turn your back on a wheat midge population.
Yeah, there you go. You
take on a single wheat midge myself.
That's probably true. Yes, I would expect that.
A teeny tiny, you know?
Yeah. Well, Tyler, one of the other projects that I know, and you mentioned this a little bit, but one of your major kind of undertakings is the Field Heroes campaign, and that promotes the, you know, awareness and development of beneficial insects and why that's important. Can you tell, I mean, I know a lot of producers in Western Canada are still pretty familiar with Field Heroes, but it's always a good thing to plug. So if you wanted to share a little bit more about this initiative, that'd be great.
Oh, great. Yeah. So Field Heroes is kind of like a cheerleader initiative for beneficial insects. When I say beneficial, it means mostly what we're looking at are the ones that eat the bad insects. So things like predators and parasitoids, but we can also look at pollinators as Field Heroes as well.
Right.
So things that'll make your canola crop look really good, and good pollination set in your canola crop makes all of the flowers turn into pods at about the same time. So down the road when you're combining, does a lot of our honey actually comes from canola fields. So good interaction there with pollinators and canola. Wheat, not so much. It's wind pollinated, so you don't really get any pollinators in there. But so Field Heroes is funded by Western Grains Research Foundation. You can find fieldheroes.ca online if you want more information. And then on Twitter, got a big Twitter campaign called @FieldHeroes. And it's just like bite-sized information, easy to digest, easy to understand, lots of full color pictures about these beneficial insects in your field. So if you're out there and you're like, whoa, I got a lot of these weird looking alligator things. What the heck are they? Go to @FieldHeroes. And you're like, oh, that is a ladybug larva. Awesome. So this is a good bug in the field, and I should just let them go about their business. Now, having said that, if you've got ladybug larvae in your field, you likely have aphids in your field as well. So 2020 was actually a really good year for aphids. We had a lot of cereal aphids. Got a lot of pictures coming in of cereal aphids just badly infesting oats. It seemed like the bird Cheerios aphid was our main culprit in there, but we also get the English grain aphid, and so some of those oat fields were pretty ugly with cereal aphids. And then the pea aphids, of course, were bad in pretty much everyone's crop. But interestingly, there was a kind of a group of Field Heroes hard to tell apart at the adult stage and at the larval stage, but they were hoverflies. So hoverfly is kind of like a bee fly. It wants you to think that it's a wasp, but it isn't. It's only got two wings and big eyes and these tiny little antennae that say, hey, I'm not actually a bee. I'm just pretending to be one. And so those guys fly around and they're good pollinators, but they find crops with aphids in them, and they lay eggs that hatch into larvae that look like just little like slug-like maggots. And so they've got sort of a pointy head, and I made some good videos actually. They they sort of have like a little spear or a knife type mouth part, and they grab the aphid, and then you can just see this spear knife thing going back and forth as it's just like piercing the aphid. It's quite awesome to watch. And they'll often like grab the thing and shake it above its head, sort of like the green lacewing larva, or the aphid lion, which is a common term for that. And so, yeah, I had to say to my students, hey, check these out. Are you guys recording these when we're doing our P. aphid counts? They're like, no, what are those things? Oh, okay. Well, this is one of the beneficial insects we need to record. So here we go. Write it down. This is a hoverfly. Go for that. So what we found, though, is there is at least three or four different species of hoverfly. And I'm not a hoverfly taxonomist by any means. So I was doing my best to try to figure out which hoverflies we had. And their larvae have the offspring are different sizes. So I imagine that ties well into which hoverfly species was actually doing the most damage to the P. aphids in the field. Mm-hmm. So I tried to rear a couple out. That means I put them in a petri dish with P. aphids and tried to see how many they would kill. And then all of them turned into pupae. And then one of them turned into a really weird looking pupa, and out came a wasp. So I actually found a parasitoid of the beneficial insect. And so this is one of those times when you say, yes, we have a parasitoid. They're typically a field hero because usually they're killing something like an aphid, and we don't like the aphid, but now they're killing the thing that is eating the aphid. So, now we can't like this wasp.
That's a cycle. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. We have wasps that attack the wasps that attack the aphids. So same kind of thing. It's like a secondary parasitoid or a hyperparasitoid. So this is where we don't like those wasps when they attack the things that we find beneficial. So very interesting. Yeah. Things that you can see as an entomologist when you're out there looking.
Very cool. Again, when you're describing some of these aphids and larvae and pupa and you know, all the different stages, I'm picturing like massive comic book opportunities here of killer wasps and parasitoids. And yeah, I think there's a real opportunity there. Yeah, hoverfly man. Yeah, exactly. Well, Tyler, this is really informative as always. It's great to hear from you. And is there anything else before we wrap up that you'd like to share with our listeners today, but any other things kind of on the go, things that you think they should know?
Well, any insect problems excite me. This year I was a little sad because we didn't have a lot of aster leafhoppers flying in, migrating into the province. They're the ones that bring aster yellows. And so I've got a project working on those. And so when they don't show up, I get a little bit sad, but it's good because then we don't get aster yellows in the field when we don't have their vector flying around, getting in, feeding on things.
Yeah. Well, maybe they'll show up when your funding is finished in a few years. And, yeah. Good things come to those who wait, right? We'll get there eventually.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't know. I'd like to say thanks to everyone who funds my research. I couldn't do it without them. And thanks to Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada for giving me such an interesting job. And thanks to you guys for giving me a platform to spread the message about beneficial insects and tell you more about pest insects too.
Yeah, anytime. We'd love to hear it. Where can people go if they want to learn more about your work or Field Heroes? Any other links or Twitter accounts that you'd like to share?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. I'm just at TylerWist1. That's pretty easy to find. Mm-hmm. I do have a YouTube channel that I should put more videos on, now that I took some from this past year. That could be an exciting thing. I've got this really awesome one of something that we sort of discovered while we were looking at quinoa, and it's a little fly, but the fly lays eggs on the quinoa, and then their larvae eat the stems of the quinoa from the inside out. Cool. So not awesome for the quinoa industry.
Not so much, no.
And, but I was looking at the flies themselves, and what we were finding was the females were leaving these scars on the leaf surface. And so did a quick video of that. And they actually have kind of a saw-like ovipositor, and she basically just shoves it under the cuticle of the plant, rips up the plant cells, and then hops back so fast that the video can barely pick it up because she's got spongy mouth parts. So she has to rip up the cells, and then she like hops back and just soaks it up with her spongy mouth parts. And then
leave no evidence.
Except for that ripped up cell. And then interestingly, once she's done this a few times, she sends her frass flying. It's like frass is insect poop. And it just fires off of the leaf. And so we were seeing these little patches all over the place going, what is that? And then didn't get it on video, but saw her doing it. So projectile pooping off of the leaf, basically.
Wow. That's a visual. So yeah.
That visual, I didn't capture that one, but I did get the saw-like ovipositor ripping apart leaves. So that's super interesting there. Yeah. Got to do a little editing and maybe I'll get those up on too. YouTube, but if you want to see any of the videos of the Field Heroes, like those are on Twitter at Field Heroes and fieldheroes.ca online, and those all came out of my lab.
Awesome.
Except for the voiceovers and the Batman touch-ups, the 1960s Adam West campy Batman, that was the brainchild of Synthesis Egg, who put those all together.
Awesome. Well, we'll link everything in our show notes here and make it easy for our listeners to go and take a look and watch some of those videos and stuff. Cause I've seen some, they're really cool. It's not often that you get a really close up view on that kind of action happening like you described. So
yeah, it's great what you can do with a microscope of camera attached.
Yeah, exactly.
And a little patience.
A lot of patience, I would imagine.
A lot of patience. Sure.
All right. Well, Tyler, thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Inputs, and we hope to chat again soon.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to Inputs, the podcast by Top Crop Manager. To hear more great research and perspectives from industry experts, visit topcropmanager.com/podcasts or catch up on past episodes wherever you listen to podcasts.